When we look in Parshat Vayeshev, or we start Parshat Vayeshev, we actually start the beginning of the Yosef story, which is interesting because we have Avraham and then tails into Yitzchak, the Yitzchak story tails into Yaakov. And over here, Yaakov is alive throughout the Yosef story to the very, very end, just about. But at some point, it seems as if Yosef becomes the main character, and Yaakov becomes the secondary, very important secondary character, but secondary character nonetheless. The other thing which is, I think, absolutely fascinating is the contours of the tension between Yehuda and Yosef, or the Yehuda and Yosef controversy, as it were. You know, the Bible critics, in terms of higher criticism, one of the main unstated motivations is that there is actually prophecy in the Chumash which takes place. So if you formulate that the Tanakh was completed before the events took place, then you'd have to say that there's prophecy. So if you push the date later and later to the time of the dual monarchy, then you can say, well, there's really no prophecy over here. It was writing about events that already took place. But the issue of the dual monarchy, which means at the point when we have Malchut Yehuda and Malchut Yisrael, that is essentially the Yosef Yehuda divide. Which means the issues that take place over here on a certain level foreshadow the tension of who's going to be the real leader, of who's going to be the real king. Now, the second point is that if, let's put it this way, based on what the Maharal wrote, we can say it like this, that if the text isn't divine, then an anti-Semite must have written this. Because just think a little bit about Malchut Yehuda, about David, about his forefathers, about Yehuda. I mean, Yehuda does not come off all that well in this week's parasha. Now, I could say that by the time we get to Vayigash, there's a change, there's a shift that takes place. But nonetheless, the behavior of Yehuda is one which is, shall we say, somewhat disappointing. But it's really the behavior of Yehuda and Yosef that I want to focus today, and not from the perspective of the political intrigue that people could have read into this at a much later point in time. Again, during the period of the dual monarchy, it's quite the opposite. The period of the dual monarchy is foreshadowed by what takes place over here. And when we, again, talk about foreshadowing or prophecy, whatever, we realize that there are 12 tribes, there are 12 sons, but there are really only two. When I say there's really only two who are the major players. And let's start. I'm going to read through. It's possible today that I won't get past the biblical text. It's possible, but I want to read it and read it with some care. If I see you've gotten the sources by now. And the only thing that I did with them is I bolded things depending on the mood I was in. So bolded certain things. From the beginning, Vayeshev Yaakov be'eretz Megurei Aviv be'eretz Kanaan. Yaakov settles in the land where his fathers lived, in the land of Kanaan. Eila told that Yaakov, Yosef ben Shiva Asrei Shana, Yoreh Techav, Bitzon, Vunar b'nei Bilhav b'nei Bilsav, Neshe Aviv, Yaveh Yosef Adibatam Ra'a El Avihim. Now that second pasuk is a mouthful. These are the generations of Yaakov, which is a normal thing to say, but then instead of talking about all 12 sons, it goes immediately into Yosef. As I said, that is something which is strange. Eila told that Yaakov should be, and Yaakov had this and this many children and this and so on. But Eila told that Yaakov, Yosef. So it really does put Yosef as the main son over here. Again, one doesn't understand how such a text could have survived had it emerged out of the I mean, again, this is exactly what the Bible critics then deal with, is when it was written and who must have produced it because of the biases involved in it. But as I said, I don't have a problem in believing in prophecy or foreshadowing, so therefore I'm not forced to put it to after the events take place. But it's very interesting in terms of foreshadowing the events that are going to take place. But this perspective that we're getting right away from Yaakov is that Yaakov's main son is Yosef. And as far as issues of kingship, if you look underneath the, a little bit under the surface, not much. I mean, it's right there staring at you, but a little bit under the surface, you actually see issues of Yosef making claims on the monarchy over here. Yaakov is appointing him, is the one thing. Yaakov gives him the Ketonet Pasim. Those of you who read the essay that I wrote this week will be reminded of something the Ramban points out, that the only other people in Tanakh who wear Ketonet Pasim are children of David HaMelech, which means that this is royal garb, this is royal clothing, and therefore the coat of many colors is supposed to be something which denotes royalty. When Yosef has his dreams and he says he's going to bow down, the brothers immediately say, are you going to be a king over us? Which means the idea of kingship is here. It's in their minds. It is part of the discussion. So therefore, Yaakov giving royal clothing on the one hand, and the brothers being very sensitive to the message of them bowing down, it's not saying, are we going to work for you? Are you going to be our master? We're going to be our slave, you know, be your slave. No. Are you going to be the king over us? And that's why, again, I'm pointing out this idea of kingship is right over here within the text. And again, you don't have to look so deeply to find it. Again, Eila toldot Yaakov, Yosef, right? The generations of Yaakov, the focus is on Yosef. He's 17 years old, ben Sheva Esrei Shana, haya ro'eh et Echav. Now, I bolded the word Echav for a very simple reason. And that is the main thing I'm going to talk about today. Brothers, brotherhood, kinship, fraternity, responsibility. Yosef, haya ro'eh et Echav betzon. That's just a very strange formulation. It's as if Yosef shepherded his brothers in the flock. I mean, it's just a very funny way of putting it. It again points towards leadership, especially when you keep in mind how many of the leaders, including David HaMelech, are going to end up being shepherds. But Yosef shepherds his brothers. V'hunar et b'nei bilhan. Now, the word na'ar is very difficult here as well. Na'ar means somebody who's young. What is it? It's being used what's as an adjective? Yes? We don't know. Does it sound like an adjective?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. It's okay. I don't know the difference between them anyway. V'hunar et hunar et b'nei bilhav b'nei zilpan eshe aviv. He did something, maybe acted immaturely, in terms of the children of Bilhah and Zilpah. V'yavei Yosef et dibatam ra'ah el avihim. See, it's actually interesting in this verse, and maybe we're reading into too much. It talks about Echav, his brothers, and then it talks about the children of B'nai Zilpah, but it does refer to them as Neshe Aviv, the wives of his father. And this is something we discussed at one point in the past. What was the relationship or the inner dynamics and the breakdown between Yosef as the favorite son versus the least favorite children, perhaps the children of Zilpah, and versus the children of Bilhah, versus the children of Leah, and what kind of dynamic would have been there. But over here, Yosef, there is this sense of brothership or brotherhood. Vayeve Yosef adibatam ra'ah el aviyam. And Yosef brings reports or bad reports to their father. Now, the single most important element which is missing over here is motivation. I don't know motivation. Again, the psychologists among us can go and they can do the analysis. I don't know what Yosef is thinking. I don't know if Yosef has their best interest in mind. If Yosef has his own best interest in mind, Yosef has his father's best interest in mind. But why is Yosef reporting things over here? One thing that you shouldn't make a mistake about, his father's happy about it. And that'll point out as we move on. But what Yosef is motivated by over here is not clear. And I'm going to give two basic possibilities, and of course there are more, but my two basic possibilities are that Yosef wants to put his brothers in the worst possible light, and therefore this is something which is a very cynical behavior on his part, Or I can say that Yosef has actually the best intentions in mind. And if we can find any proofs one way or the other, that would be very good, and it also will help us a lot in reading the rest of the story. I don't see either. I said, I'm just bringing up what are his motivations. I don't know. I know his act. The Torah tells me actions. The Torah doesn't tell me what the motivation is. Which, you know,
maybe she's asking, what would be positive about his doing it?
Well, you know, there. I tried to have this conversation with my students yesterday, but there of course, there are limitations. And let's say there is somebody, I don't care what age right now, I don't care if he's 5, 10, 15, 20, 25. If you have somebody in a peer group who's doing something which is wrong, something which is dangerous, something which is could be self-destructive, I can start going on gradations of this, at which point does somebody report it to a higher authority, and at which point would that be seen as something which is really not acceptable in a social group? Which means, when is honesty something which is respected, and when is honesty something which you don't want to hear at all? I mean, I once had a wonderful opportunity last year. I was asked to give a class, and a bunch of women, and my wife wasn't there. Normally, if I give a class to women, she's there. She wasn't there. So I asked them the question that every man wants to know. If your wife asks you, do I look fat in this, what are you supposed to say? No, the right answer. No, it's not the clothing that makes you look fit. No, I don't know. Anyway, it's the. I did ask this to my students. I say, if a friend asks you, "Do I look good in this?" Do you say yes or no? So what's the answer? It depends how close your friend is. If you can't stand them, then you say you look great. If you like them, then you tell the truth. Which means that you should now all know that anybody who's ever told you look good. Okay, everybody, calm down now. Which my point over here is goes back to Yosef. But Yosef telling these things over, is this because of care? Is this because he really cares about his brothers and he sees something wrong? He brings dibatam ra'ah. He tells over bad things that they've done. So is it to make himself look good? Again, that's what I'm saying. It goes back to motivations. Is he telling his father, well, you won't believe what he did? And of course, what's the result when everyone else looks bad? Then Yosef looks good. Or is Yosef doing this because he's coming with real sincerity to his father? Listen, this is what they're doing. You need to come in over here. Which means, is Yosef almost like a quasi-parent now? Again, I said I want evidence one way or the other. One thing you know about Yosef all along the line is that Yosef really does seem to be a quasi-parent. Yosef is called Avrech. Yosef is called that he's a father when it comes to wisdom, even though he's young in years. Even in the very next, is it the next verse? Yes, even the very next verse, when it says in Pasuk Gimel, V'Yisrael Ahavet Yosef Mikol Banav. One thing which is interesting is that it shifts over here from Yaakov to Yisrael. So is this on a national level or on an individual family level? I'm just saying that shift is a very interesting shift. V'Yisrael Ahavet Yosef Mikol Banav. He loved Yosef more than all of his other children. Ki Ven Zekunim Hulo. Now that's a very strange phrase. Ki Ven Zekunim. Ben Zekunim can mean one of two things. The way it's used in modern Hebrew is to say that he's the child of his old age. If he's his child of his old age, that is somewhat challenging because he probably had a number of brothers, a number, not just one, who were within a couple of years of him. And on top of all that, there is really a Ben Zekunim, and that's his younger brother Binyamin, which means why would you call him the Ben Zekunim when Binyamin was really the Ben Zekunim? Which is why the Targum Onkelos over here calls him Bar Hakim. What does it mean to be a zaken? A zaken, it means old, or a zaken could be wise. So the Targum Onkelos understands Ben Zekunim, he loved him because of his wisdom, because he was a wise person, which means if that, again, according to Onkelos, what's flowing over here is Yosef's giving these reports, Yosef is acting like a quasi-father. Yaakov loves more. Yisrael loves him because of his wisdom, because of his maturity, and because of his ability to almost parent his siblings, even though he's almost the youngest of them. And finally, that verse then ends. Pasuk Gimel ends, V'asaluk tonet pasim. And he makes for him these royal, this royal clothing, which again seems to be pointing towards the coronation of Yosef. So we have over here a combination of Elotolot Yaakov Yosef, that Yosef seems to be the main child. We have Yosef over here acting with great wisdom, Yosef caring about his brothers. Again, motivation is one which I am filling in. That's something which is not said in the text, but I'm reading that into it, and I admit that. And finally, it says that Yaakov makes for him this royal garb. Yes.
The question is there anything special about the colors of which he made his robe?
Probably.
So does each color stand for something?
Most likely. I just don't know what colors they were. I can make it up if you want. If I were a real rabbi, I'd be making this up.
Yeah, I realize.
Yeah. I don't know. It depends on various midrashim and the parallels that they draw to it. Do you draw parallels to the clothing of the Kohen Gadol? I just read a book review. Somebody wrote of my book. Apparently, I wrote about this. I don't know what I said, but but apparently, I wrote something about this. It was very good. Okay, let's continue. Pasuk Dalid. Vayiru Echav. Now again, Echav is bolded over here. His brothers see, ki oto ahav avihim, that the father loved him, Mikol Echav, more than all the other children. Vayisna'u oto, and they hated him. That's, by the way, yisna'u is a very strong word. Velo yichlu dabru l'shalom, and they couldn't speak with, and they just couldn't speak with him peacefully. So once again, all of you should be very happy that we have another dysfunctional family, where we have a favorite child. The Gemara, by the way, stresses, Midrash stresses, that Yaakov was mistaken for conducting himself like this because of all the problems that end up emerging from this. Yosef dreams and he tells his brothers and they hate him more, or continue to hate him. By the way, at this point, it even tells us what the dream is, and it's not clear if this is about the dream which we're about to tell, although it sounds that way. Listen to the dream. Where their representative in the dream bows down to his. His brothers say to him, again, they can't speak with him peacefully. What do they say? This is what I intimated before. Hamaloch timloch aleinu. Are you going to be the king on top of us? Which means, again, kingship is the issue over here. Kingship is the subtext. Yosef is an unaccepted king by his brothers. He's coronated by his father, but he's not accepted by his brothers. Im mashol timshol banu? Are you really going to rule over us? And they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. Which means over here, again, we have Yosef, who is ridiculously talented and insightful and has leadership capabilities. The only problem with his leadership capabilities is that his brothers don't want to follow. It's good to have leadership capabilities, but it doesn't mean that they really accepted it. And again, the relationship is one to his brothers. And he tells about this other dream. And he, again, Pasuk Yud, he tells his father and his brothers. Pasuk Yud Aleph, his brothers were jealous of him. By the way, those of you who hate Gematria, Yosef and Gematria is 156. The Midrash points out that the word kin'ah, jealousy, is also 156. It also points out that Tzion is 156 and draws a parallel between Yosef and between Zion, between Yosef and between Jerusalem. How Yosef is beautiful and Jerusalem is beautiful, how Yosef was the point of jealousy between his children and Zion is the jealousy of all the nations of the world. And it draws a number of parallels between Yosef and between Zion, and of course, as I said, all of them have 156 as the gematria. V'iknu bo echav, aviv shamar et davar. His brothers were jealous of him, and his father, and here's a good question, what does shamar mean? Rashi actually says that he can't wait for all this to come true. Shamar et davar. V'ilchu echav l'ro'ot et son avihim b'shchem. And his brothers go to go with their flocks to Shechem. Vayomi Yisrael, and again notice it's Yisrael over here. Vayomi Yisrael Yosef, hello achecha ro'im b'Shechem, l'chav eshlachecha le'em, v'yomer lo hineni. Your brothers are gone, they went out to work the flocks in Shechem. Yosef says, here I am. Now, what does Yaakov do? Vayomer lo lechna, go, re'e et shlom achecha, see how your brothers are, ve'et shlom hatzon, and see how the flocks are, ve'heshivenu davar, and come back and tell me what's going on. So now I'm going to ask you, is Yaakov happy with Yosef reporting to him? Yeah. Okay. Black and white, that Yaakov is with him on this. He not only is with him on this, he's facilitating this. He's asking him to do this. This is a role where we saw before that Yosef comes and talks about his brothers. Yaakov is very happy about this relationship. Because he's the favored brother. Why should he have to work? Right. So the question there is what it means. Was he really Re'etzon, or was he or was he shepherding his brothers? Again, it was a very strange formulation there. And he was sent from the depths of Chevron. There's a beautiful Rashi on this, the depths of Chevron. Rashi understands the depths of Chevron is where Avraham is buried, underneath the ground. And the depths of Chevron comes, according to Rashi, is the Brit Bein Abtarim that has to take place, that has to be fulfilled. V'yimtza'eu ish, we once again bump into an anonymous man, many anonymous people in Sefer Bereishit. I think all of them are here to do God's work, which is why so often they're described as being angels. A person finds him. This is actually, at face value, completely unnecessary and should have been edited out. Yaakov's going someplace. He gets lost. He stops. He asks for directions. Yosef, he gets lost. He asks for directions. Maybe the chiddush is that he asks for directions. Maybe the fact that men never ask And look at this. We have a biblical source for getting lost, but not only a biblical source over here for asking directions, but he accepts it. He was offered, but he accepted it. He didn't say it's okay. I could find it myself. I have something very funny to say about that, but I won't say it publicly. Anyway. Oh, she knows what I'm going to say. It's not that funny. Maybe it is. Okay. There are two points here. One point is that later on, when Yosef will say to his brothers, it wasn't you who sold me, it was God who did this, Yosef sees this as being an act of God. I'm not going to say that this is an angel. It's not an angel. That doesn't concern me. The fact is that if God wants you to end up someplace, you're going to end up someplace. And you could be traveling east, you're going to end up west, you're going to be traveling north, you're going to end up south. And that's really what happens. Yosef starts by Chevron, he goes towards Shechem, his brothers are in Dothan, he ends up getting there, and he ends up, of course, going down to Egypt. And Yosef understands this as being the will of God. So that's one aspect over here. But the other aspect is what he is what he says. And the man says, Mativakesh. How would you translate Mativakesh? Tivakesh. What do you want? What is your desire? Tivakesh is strong. Huh? What are you searching for? Vayomer, and Yosef says, Et achai anochi mivakesh. I am looking for my brothers. And the truth is that it's probably the most important verse in the entire Yosef trilogy of the next couple of Parshiot. It's probably the truest thing that he says, and it's probably true on many, many levels. Yosef wants his brothers. What's the problem? His brothers don't want him. So this is an honest answer with nobody listening. Bumps into some guy. What do you want? He goes, I want my brothers. Which means the word tivakesh is actually a very strong word. It's not, it's what are you looking for, but it's what are you looking for with the various levels to what are you looking for. Is a strong word. Which means, what do you want? So over here, asking Yosef what he wants, he's being very truthful what he wants. He goes, I want my brothers. Not just geographically, I want to know where they are. I want my brothers. That's why, meaning Yosef is, he's meeting some guy in a diner. They're sitting there and they're having a cup of coffee together. And he goes, you know, what is it that you really want in life? He goes, I want my brothers. That's what this conversation is over here. And I think there are two reasons to include the conversation. One is, maybe three even. One is the most basic shot. He went to Shechem, but they ended up being Dotan. Although the reality is it's not so important. Had it skipped over all of this and just said, Yosef comes and he sees his brothers, does it really make a difference he got lost along the way? Does it really make a difference that somebody helped him find it? So I'm saying, for shot purposes, you can say he was going to Shechem, he ended up in Dotan. Okay, if we need all the details, but then you have to ask yourself, how many times does the Torah not give you all the details? That in this particular case, we need the details? Which then leads me to the second point, in terms of this issue of that this is the hand of God over here, which is guiding the situation. Again, this is from Eimek Chevron, from the depths of Chevron. This is something which has to take place. Yosef has to end up in Egypt. Yosef can later on say, it wasn't you who did it, God was behind this. You were just the ones who actually were the agents of God to make sure that this happened. But on this other level, it's not just the question which is important, it's Yosef's answer, which is just so stirring, when Yosef says, it's my brothers that I want. And as I said, that feeling of Yosef, that wanting to be with his brothers, Yosef wants the relationship with his brothers. The problem is the relationship which has been forged is one of him being in a position of power, and they don't want that position. They don't want him to be in this position of power. And let's see how this plays out. I know you know how it plays out, but let's see. Yes.
Yes. What's the significance of Joseph having planted on him a golden goblet, and when the Egyptians...
Not now. A couple of weeks from now. We're not there yet with the goblet.
Okay.
Be fair. You're asking me next week.
Okay, I'll hold it for next
Hold it for next week.
Okay.
And it's very significant. Should I give you my favorite answer?
Sure.
I wrote about it in my book. Okay, but I did write about this at length. Let's continue. Pasuk Yud Zayin. In Pasuk Yud Zayin, the guy tells him where they went. Vayomer ish nasu mizeki shemati omer nechod otan veylech Yosef acher echav. Yosef goes after his brothers. Again, the word brother I keep on bolding over here because the word brother is the most important word. Vayimtzein bedotan, and he finds Dotan. Vayiru otomi rechok. They see him from afar. By the way, notice there's no word of brother right now. Vayiru oto mirachok. They see him from afar. Uvaterim yikrav aleihem. Before he gets there. Vitnakulu oto lahamito. And they conspire to kill him. All of this over here, there's one thing which is absent. And again, it didn't have to be here, but just notice it's not here. There's no sign of brotherhood over here. They see him from afar. They conspire to kill him. And he's just this him. Vayomri ish el echav. El achiv. Now achiv is there, but it's not to include Yosef. It's one of the brothers said to the other. And over here also, the word achiv is completely unnecessary. Vayomri ish el achiv. So here there is a sense of brotherhood. Hinei bala chalamot halazeba. Here comes the dreamer of dreams. Again, no sign of brotherhood, no sign of kinship. Vata luchuv nahargeu v'nashlicheu ba'achad haborot v'amru chayu ra'av alchitu v'nira mayu chalamotav. The whole plan is already spelled out. Yosef's not even there yet. Let's kill him. Let's throw him in one of the pit. We'll say when a wild animal ate him, and we'll see what will be of his dreams. Again, notice not one word of brotherhood coming from their side. Vayishma Ruvain, and Ruvain hears. Vayitzileu miyadam, and he saves them from their hands. Vayamalona kinu nafesh. Let's not kill a person. What's missing? Again, in my mind, this is just so obvious over here. That it's almost going out of the way that they can't use the word brother when they're referring to him. Brother is gone over here. And even, what?
Not even his name.
And not even his name. It's this is so, what's the word? It's so impersonal. It's so impersonal. He's this object, or perhaps the subject of their hatred, and he's like this non-entity. That's what's here. And even Reuven, who's trying to save him, it doesn't say what he should have said. What should he say?
He's our brother.
He's our brother. You know, but Yomer Leim Reuven, Al Tishpachu Dam, don't spill blood. Hashlichu Oto Elabor, Hazeh, Asher Bamidbar, V'yad Al Tishlichu Bo, Laman Hitzil Oto, Miyadam L'Hashivo El Aviv. That's the closest he can get. He goes, don't kill him, we'll put him over here, meanwhile, in a pit. By the way, at face value, what is Reuven actually saying? Reuven is saying that murder is, he has a motivation, and he has what he says. Over here, the Torah does tell us the motivation. What did he actually say? The brothers say, let's kill him. What does Reuven say? He says, let's not kill him, because killing is very messy. Let's just put him in a pit. Right, let's just put him in the pit. The pit then will take care of him, but his motivation was to return him to his father. Again, Reuven's moral stance, let's not kill him, I don't know how moral it is, at least the way he articulates it. What's his moral stance? That murder is messy. What's his moral stance? Let us not spill blood. Why? Because spilling, not because he's your brother, but rather let's not spill blood because, first of all, it's very messy emotionally. All kinds of guilt afterwards, flashbacks, screaming, blood spurting and all this. What do we need this for? Right? What does he say? Put him in a pit. It's much easier emotionally. But even when he seems to state a moral point, his moral point is not, he's your brother. But rather, what words does he say? Look, how neutral is it? What does he say? Lo nakenu nafesh. Let's not take a life. It's not, hold on, which life? This is your brother. You know, even Esav, when he wanted to kill Yaakov, he says, okay, well, wait for my father is dead. There's no such consideration over here. When they conspire to kill him, let's kill him on the spot, and we'll and it's quite the opposite. Not only they're not going to wait for their father to be dead, they're going to say, let's kill him on the spot, and well, this is what we're going to tell our father. They already have the whole thing worked out, and the excuse already built in, and what are we going to tell him? The narrative is already all created, and that's what's fascinating over here.
Could it be that Reuven feels guilty about the Bila affair?
It could be. Reuven most likely, he's focusing on his father, he's not focusing on his brother. Reuven may very well know that he's the one who's going to have the most responsibility. He's the one who's going to get yelled at the most, and you're the one who was the oldest, and you should have done something. And Reuven over here is talking about, he's concerned about his father, but he's not concerned about Yosef. And how do I know that? Because it says that's his motivation. His motivation is to return him to his father. It doesn't say his motivation is to save Yosef's life. His motivation is to return him to his father. Which leads me then to what happens next. V'yikasher ba Yosef, all that was preparation. Notice, v'yikasher ba Yosef el Echav. Yosef comes to his brothers. So now suddenly brother is back over there, because the brother issue is a one-way street. Yosef comes to his brothers. V'yifshitu et Yosef, et kutnato, they strip him off of his coat, et ketonet tapasim, asher alav, they strip him off of his royalty, of his kingship, of his special coat, of the thing which points towards their father's favoritism. They took him, and they threw him in the pit, and the bor was empty, there was no water. They sit down to eat bread. They lift up their eyes. They see a caravan of Yishmaelites traveling from Gad, and they're carrying all these things traveling to Egypt. One second. Unlikely. Vayomer Yehuda el Echav. Notice what's back again. The whole time that they act towards him, they rip off his leg. The word brother is missing completely. And now the brothers among one another, it keeps using the word brothers. It could have just been Vayomer Yehuda. And you just realize the word brother over here is used very, very directedly and with care in the whole narrative. Vayomi Yuda il Echav, Ma betza ki naharog et achinu. Now, here is the first time we hear the word ach. And I'm unsure, and this is exactly what I want to get to. It goes back to the issue of motivation. Yehuda says something which is either the most cynical thing in the world or not. How would I read it as cynical? First of all, the word betza. The word betza is a charged word. What it implies financial gain. Here, for all the anti-Semites in the room, the Jew is saying, what am I going to gain financially by killing my brother? We can make a deal over here and at least make a little money over here. Let's turn this into a win-win. We get rid of him, we make some money. You just kill him, what do you make out of it? So, but the thing which jumps out at me, and I hope now all of you notice it as well, now he's being referred to as a brother. So is Yehuda being impossibly cynical by calling him a brother at this point? Or is there something which is deeper over here? Again, Yosef definitely feels towards his brothers this act of brother. Right? I'm looking for my brothers. That's Yosef. He wants his brothers. What about Yehuda? Does Yehuda have this sense of kinship, this sense of brotherhood, or is it lacking by Yehuda? And that's really what I'm going to try to get to the time that we have remaining. The fact that, let me just continue this. Vayomi Yehuda alachav, ma betza kinero getachinu, v'chisino atamo, l'chu v'nim kreinu l'ishma'ilim. Let's sell him to the Ishmaelim. Do you all, of course you all realize the irony. Okay, not yet. You will in a second. Avram Avinu had a son. He actually had two sons. One son was the accepted son. The other son was the rejected son. The rejected son is Ishmael. The loved and the accepted son is Yitzchak. How ironic do you think Yehuda feels it is that at this very moment when they're contemplating what to do with Yosef, that it's specifically Yishmaelim that go by? This is a sign from heaven that Yosef is to be rejected just like Yishmael was rejected. Which means we're going to take Yosef and sell him to the Yishmaelim. We're going to send him away with Yishmael, let him go with them, just like Yishmael was sent away, he was sent away. This is a sign from heaven that this is the right thing to do. And by the way, if no one ever said it, I said it, so it's okay. You can write it down, and now it's written also. Yeah, because it's true. What I'm saying right now is true. Yeah.
Was Joseph sold a second time? The very first
you asked that already, and I said it's quite unlikely he was sold twice. The problem is the two different words being used over here, Yishmael or Midianim. And more likely than not, they mean the same thing, that they were Yishmaelim who lived in Midian. There's a lot of confusion on this, and you just ruined completely my shira I was going to give on Shabbat, so hopefully no one's going to hear what I just now said. Okay, let us continue. Pasuk Kaf Zayin. Again, Yehuda says, "L'chu v'nim kareinu l'Yishmaelim, let us sell it to the Yishmaelim," and that's why I bolded Yishmaelim, because I think that to Yehuda that was incredibly meaningful, because Yishmael, who's Yishmael? He's a brother who's not really a brother. So therefore, who's Yosef? He's a brother who's not really a brother. Let's send him to Yishmael instead of having him stay with us. V'yadeinu al tehubo, and therefore our hands will not be upon him, ki achinu b'sareinu hu. Because he's our flesh and blood. So again, I'm going to ask you, Yehuda, you hear him talking about brotherhood. You hear him talk, but nonetheless he says, but let's sell him. So we don't know what to do. V'yishmu echav, and his brothers listen to him. So over here we have this wonderful situation of Yosef who's being seen as a brother but not a brother. Yosef sees his brothers as brothers, and Yehuda sees him as a brother and therefore wants to get rid of him because the brother that he sees him like is actually Yishmael and not the brother like his other brother. So that seems to be what's going on over here. When they bring the clothing, they cannot say, use the terms of brotherhood at all. When they bring the coat to their father, they take it, they dip in blood. They send it to their father. Is this your son's coat? Not, is this our brother's coat? Is this your son's coat? Okay. Chapter 38, Perek Lamed Chet, then goes in, and we have sort of like an intermission from the Yosef story, and we have this whole story about Yehuda, which spans a whole bunch of years. This also drove the biblical critics crazy, because in terms of chronology, you know the real problem is that most Bible critics did not watch enough television. Because when you watch television, then you have, or movies, you have such thing called character development. You'll take one character, develop to a certain point, and stop, and then you go back and take another character, develop them to a certain point, and then stop, and then you have the two characters meeting up, right? This is basic over here. But the fact that, meaning, the Bible critics were sometimes very troubled that the Torah is a very bad history book. What they didn't realize is that it wasn't trying to be a history book, and it was actually a very good book of theology. But if you're not so concerned with theology, and you only focused on history, you say, well, what a bad history book this is. No, this is a wonderful book of theology, and the theology which is now going to emerge is one which is fascinating. Yehuda now gets married. Yehuda now has a problem with his brothers. He leaves his brothers. The Midrash over here spells out maybe they're upset with him. They're mad with him for the advice. Yaakov is very upset. Yaakov is very sad. Yaakov is mourning, and all this is because of Yehuda's idea. Of course, Yehuda wasn't the one who said to kill him. Their idea was to kill him. Yehuda's idea was, let's sell him, but they're willing to blame Yehuda for everything. And that is, of course, the problem of leadership. Yehuda took responsibility over here, and he'll now be blamed for everything and anything. Vayar Shem Yehuda bat ish Kna'ani. Yehuda now marries a Canaanite. Now, that itself is interesting, because that's one of the things that has actually been stressed in the last generation. Try to stay away from Canaanites. Yehuda marries a Canaanite. Yehuda has three children with this Canaanite unnamed woman. The first one dies, and then the second one dies. But I want to pause for a second over here. Why the first one dies, we're not sure. Why the second one dies, we are told. The Midrashim claim that both of them did the exact same thing, and there seems to be a focus on sexuality independent of procreation. And itself is interesting in terms of Canaanites, because Canaanites come from the family of Ham. And I'll say it again, I've said this before, just about all men who behave improperly in Sefer Bereishit are all children of Ham, especially all men who behave improperly sexually. So over here, the fact that Yehuda marries a Canaanite and now has children who are from the line of Ham, will therefore, we should not be all that surprised when they don't behave in the way that they're supposed to behave, especially, again, when it comes to sexual misbehavior. And therefore, you have Avimelech, and you have Paro, and you have the city of you have Shechem, you have, where else? Stone. All of these people are coming from Ham. All of these people act inappropriately sexually. Ham, from the word hot, Rav Shmuel Hirsch said, hot-blooded, poor impulse control, people who then act out. Over here, we find now Yehuda has children who are far more Canaanite than he would like. But that's not what interests me. That's just interesting. What interests me is something else. Pasuk Chet. Vayoma Yehuda la'onan. And the word onan itself may indicate part of the sexual misbehavior. Bo el eshet achicha v'yabem oto v'kim zera la'achicha. Now, later on in the Torah, we're going to find out there is such a thing called yibum. There is such a thing called levirate marriage, that when one brother dies without children, the other brother takes responsibility, will marry the widow in order to keep the family name alive, as it were. Notice that Yehuda is concerned about fraternity. Yehuda is concerned how one brother care for his brother. Again, this goes back to the previous chapter. How concerned was Yehuda about his own brothers? Over here we find Yehuda being very concerned about brotherhood, but when it's his children, which of course is a wonderful message. If you want your children to get along, then you should probably put more, and you should invest far more in your relationship with your siblings. Why? Don't expect them to somehow just wake up and to figure this out by themselves. People need role models. And over here, Yehuda is expecting his brothers to behave in a certain way, but lo and behold, his sons are not interested in acting and taking responsibility for their brother's soul. And again, I can ask the same question. To what extent was Yehuda interested in taking responsibility for his brother's soul? For what responsibility? To what extent did Yehuda feel responsibility for his brother? And now you can say, yes, he did. He said, this is our brother. How can we kill him? Let's sell him. Yehuda's behavior over here, and that's why I said, my big question mark so far is, what was Yosef's motivation when he tells over? What's Yehuda's motivation? Both of them we see an interest in brotherhood, even though you can put lots of asterisks over there in terms of their interest in brotherhood, but they're the only two who are expressing this interest in brotherhood, while all the others seem to be devoid of this. And again, the others can't even refer to Yosef as a brother. Yehuda does. But his conclusion, he's a brother, let's not kill him. Over here, when Yehuda's own children now have to confront issues of fraternity, issues of brotherhood, again, look very carefully what it says here. Pasuk Ched again. Vayomi Yehuda lonan, bo'el eshet achicha, v'yabei motav, v'kim zera la'achicha. Again, keep your brother's name alive. V'yadei onan ki lo ya'azara, that it's not going to be his. What does he care about his brother? Which means the exact issue over here is non-caring for his brother. And therefore, when he had relations with Tamar, by the way, he didn't refuse to marry her, he was happy to marry her, but he just practiced coitus interruptus, and therefore he was not interested in keeping his brother's name alive. Again, he wasn't interested in Zerah le'achiv for his brother. So we find with Yehuda's son a lack of brotherhood, and what happens then? So of course he dies as well. The next thing which happens is Yehuda's unfortunate relationship with Tamar, which is continued. This is, again, once again, a part which it's hard to imagine in any religion, and this is fundamentally something Christianity never understood. I mean, you think about Jesus, he comes from a supposed virgin birth, and over here, our messianic line will include Lot and his daughter, and will include Yehuda and a prostitute. Ah, it's not really a prostitute, he only thinks she's a prostitute. She's only dressed as a prostitute. The reality is that she is his daughter-in-law, and that makes things a whole lot better. And this is, of course, in fact, the Davidic line, because, of course, what Christianity never understood is that the purpose of Mashiach is to fix the world, and to fix the world from the state that the world is in is a state of sin. And you fix the world from a state of sin by repairing sin, but not by avoiding it completely and making believe it doesn't exist. Yes.
She's still considered his daughter-in-law even though her husband
died? I don't know what to say. I don't know. In terms of halacha, yes. Yeah, in terms of halacha, yes. The relationship with daughter-in-law will stay forever. So she knows that Yehuda has not been behaving properly, and she is stuck in this marriage, and the first two sons die, which again, I've mentioned this before, but if you were Yehuda and you just lost a son, the moral thing for him to have done would have been to contact his father and to say, listen, I know what it's like to lose a son. It's the most devastating thing in the world. I know how you feel, and I have to tell you something. You may never speak to me again, but your son is not dead. And Yehuda should have seen his loss of a son as some kind of divine punishment. And Yehuda definitely, again, if I were writing this and I wanted to make Yehuda into a hero, there's a couple small edits over here that can make Yehuda look much, much better. Which goes back to my point to the Maharal. The fact that we can have the Davidic family coming from this kind of relationship and this kind of behavior and not, you know, from something which is far more elevated itself points to the absolute truth of the Torah. And when he loses a second son, all the more so, he should say, I caused my father to think he lost one son. Now I've really lost two sons. He should go and try to rectify the situation. Yeah.
But isn't it part of his character development that he gets it in tiny increments?
Yes, correct. As I said, if I were writing it, that's why I'm not a good writer. If I were writing it, then I would, you would insist on the increments?
Yes.
Okay. See, that's why you're a better editor than I am a writer. We like epiphanies. We love these.
Right. But in theory, he really does feel in tiny increments.
So you like the writing?
I do.
Okay. You know why? It just may become a bestseller. So, now, if only you can get the movie rights. So, What then happens is he wants to be intimate with this woman who he sees on the side of the road. Of course, you know, the further irony over here is that Tamar has been waiting as a living widow for many, many years, lonely, listening to her biological clock get louder and louder, and what's going to be with her. And again, aside from the loneliness. And now Yehuda, his wife dies, and suddenly he's lonely, and he needs companionship, which means Yehuda doesn't seem to be getting messages very, very quickly. He's sort of increments, really, really small increments over here. And Yehuda sees her, and he approaches her, and he hits on her. Right? What was this? Right? Source 3. Vayura Yehuda v'yechshever lezona. Yehuda sees her and thinks that she's a prostitute. Ki kista paneh, for she covered her face. Vayeta leha el haderech vayomer. And he says to her, this is, again, one of the great pickup lines of all time. Havo na avo elayach. Can I have sex with you, please? Ki lo yada ki kalaso hi, for he did not know that it was his daughter-in-law. Vatomer, and she says right away, mati tenli. What are you going to pay? And he says, oh, I'll send you, you know, choice goat for my flock. Try that one. I'm not even going to go there. So, and basically he was saying, the goat's in the mail. The goat's in the mail. I'm gonna send you a goat. And she very wisely says, "Vatomer itikain eravon." Yeah, what are you gonna give me as collateral in the meantime? Over here we have this word eravon, this word collateral being introduced. And the word collateral is actually important. He then gives her collateral relations, and then out of this then will emerge, as I said, King David will end up coming out of this relationship. The child's name over here is going to be Peretz. When we say in Lachadodi, Ben Partzi, the child of Peretz, this is who we're referring to, the child of Yehuda. And as they say, the rest is history. Now, why is all this significant? So far we have Yehuda, who we're just not sure what to do with Yehuda. Why don't I say we're not sure what to do with him? Because Yehuda, on the one hand, expresses certain elements of brotherhood. We just don't love the way that they were expressed. But when it comes to his own brother, we don't like the way they did it. When it comes to his children, you know, you guys got to take responsibility. And we see that there's something here. Later on, when Yosef is in Egypt, unbeknownst to all that this is in fact Yosef, and Yosef holds the key, as it were, to all the food, and they have to send down Binyamin in order to get food, is the context of source number 4. Varov kaved ba'aretz, and the famine was very strong in the land. V'yikesher kilu lechol teshever she'evin mi'mitzrayim. And when they finished eating all the food they brought from Egypt, v'yom aleim aviyim, father said, Yaakov said, shivu shivu lonumat olcho, bring us some food. You notice avihim, it's no longer Yaakov as Yaakov. Yaakov is the father. Yaakov is no longer the focus. Yaakov is now the old man. But Yomer love Yehuda. Yehuda is the main person at this point. Lemor ha'ed ha'id banu ha'ish lemor al tepar ne'bil ti achicha mitchem. He goes, you can't come unless you bring back your brother. By the way, the brother who he calls a brother is Binyamin, who is a brother. Im yeshcha mishalayach etachinu itanu nerdav v'nishbarat lacha ochel. If you send your brother, we'll give you food. Then Yaakov goes into this whole discussion. Again, he's called Yisrael here. Why do you tell him that you have another brother? And this is the guy asked about it, another brother. Okay. Pasachet, Vayom Yehuda el Yisrael Aviv, Shlacha hanar iti, send the boy with me. V'nakum v'nelcha, we're going to get up, we're going to go. V'nichia, and we will live. V'lo namote natai, gam anachnu, gam ata, gam tapenu. Anochi, now you have the word anochi being used again over here. I, anochi, erevnu miyadi. I will serve as collateral. I will give you the collateral. Now, the word collateral over here is very interesting because where did we see this before? We saw this in the whole Yehuda Tamar episode. What emerges, again, if we want to speak about this growth by increments, is Yehuda ends up becoming somebody else. Yehuda ends up somebody who's willing to place his own life in danger for his brother, for Binyamin. And of course, that's the key. Later on, when the goblet, if we want to get back to the goblet, is found in Binyamin's bag, Yehuda at that point says, I will be your slave instead of him. Yehuda is willing to take responsibility. Later on, Yehuda is going to say to Yosef, again, not knowing that it's Yosef, that I serve as an Eravon. I serve as a collateral for my brother. My point is that the Yehuda that we find later on, the one who takes responsibility, the one who speaks of brotherhood, the one who's willing to be a collateral, what I wanted to point out is that all of those elements are already found over here earlier. They're all found in this week's parsha. They're found in terms of Yehuda's sense of brotherhood, which we don't know what to do with, on the one hand during the sale itself when he speaks of brotherhood, and we find on the other hand this issue of the Eravon, of the collateral. We find that within in chapter 38 in terms of the relationship with Tamar, which means both of these are going to, you know, come and make an appearance later on in a completely different way, where Yehuda now will become the Yehuda who we love and respect and so on. But I'm just pointing out that these elements are not what we would call yesh me'ayin. They don't just emerge out of nowhere. These elements are there at the basic level in this parasha, which then goes back again. I'm not sure what to do in terms of Yehuda's motivation, which means, is Yehuda's motivation totally and exclusively cynical? Or is Yehuda's motivation that he does feel some kind of sense of brotherhood? Again, it's hard for me to call Yehuda so hypocritical that he would insist with his own sons that you guys act like brothers, even after death, and with his own brother, there's no sense of brotherhood at all. But there is a sense of brotherhood. But the only problem with his sense of brotherhood is it just led him to the wrong place, and it led him to completely wrong conclusion. And I'm going to claim, I did it before, I'm going to claim again, that Yehuda must have seen the fact that these were Yishmaelites going by at that particular moment as a sign from heaven that he was supposed to sell him to Yishmael, and that in fact this is a sign from heaven that Yosef is supposed to be treated like Yishmael, and just as Yishmael is rejected, so too. I mean, if you notice, it says they sit down, they throw him in the pit because of Reuven. They sit down to eat food. They lift up their eyes and see the caravan of the Yishmaelites going by. And then Yehuda says, what we gain by killing him, let's sell him to the Yishmaelites. Which means Yehuda must see Yishmael as a brother, but as a brother who was sent away. And Yehuda feels, therefore, he has a sign from God, even though that this is a brother, he has a sign from God that Yehuda is supposed to, that Yosef is supposed to be sent away, just as Ishmael was sent away. And as far as he's concerned, he's following a divine script over here. Of course, this is the danger of finding signs from God, especially towards somebody who you don't like, because people will tend to see signs which they want to see. My point for today, and by the way, on a mystical level, the one who goes into this discussion more than anybody else is a Hasidic work known as the Tiferet Shlomo. Any of you who want a great deal of homework to do, you can look at source number 12. He goes into this whole idea of Arvut, Yiskol Yisrael, Arevim Zelazeh, all Jews have responsibility for one another, and he thinks that the key of Malchut, the key of kingship, is be able to be somebody who has responsibility for the collective, and he believes that Yehuda starts this concept of Arevut right over here, this one of feeling responsible for the others, and that's why Yehuda earns his kingship. A matter of fact, it's a Mechilta. Mechilta is a quite ancient source, in source number 10. There's a whole difference of opinion. It says, Amalem be'ezes chut natal Yehuda tamalchut. At which point did Yehuda deserve to be melech? And there are different opinions over here. That's not fair.
No, because Yosef had that arvut from the very, very first.
Correct,
verse.
Correct. And it goes back to motivation. And that's why I said it again. The two over here who take responsibility, correct, who have arvut, are Yosef and Yehuda. Yosef's feeling of responsibility continues throughout the rest of his life. He takes care of the brothers, which means the idea of Yosef's arvut is always there. Yehuda is the one that ends up getting developing. And that's why at the end of the day, as much as we don't like it, there are two kings afterwards. There is a dual monarchy afterwards. there is a king of Yehuda, and there is a king of Yisrael, and one comes from the family of Yosef, and one comes from the family of Yehuda, and eventually we're going to have two Mashiachs, one coming from the family of Yehuda, and one coming from the family of Yosef, because these are the two brothers who know how to take responsibility. But as we said, Yosef seems to take, again, you can read in Motivations, Yosef seems to be the one who always takes the high road. Yehuda is the one who always takes the messier, far more complicated road. But the question is where you end up at the end of the day. Yes?
But isn't it also said that in a place where Shuvah stand, a tzaddik can't stand?
Correct, correct. Correct, correct. Meaning, if you want a parallel, again, a little sharper, you just have to go as far as to parallel Yehuda with his daughter-in-law dressed as a prostitute, having relations with her, versus the next chapter, Yosef meeting Mrs. Potiphar and saying, and here's to you, Mrs. Potiphar, right? And I talked to her. I said, absolutely not. And I would be sinning against God and sinning against my master, and therefore I will absolutely not do it. And you have Yosef taking the high road on this, and not, again, the parallels that's staring at you. That's chapter 38, that's chapter 39. Yehuda with Tamar and Yosef refusing Mrs. Potiphar. So again, the parallel between the two is a clear parallel that goes through. They both take responsibility. Yosef, arguably, you see it from the very beginning, and that's why I'm willing to give Yosef the benefit of the doubt that he cares about his brothers, and that's why he reports things. His father wants him to do this, as I think that you can't argue with me about this. His father sends him to do this. His father wants him to do it. His father sees him as a ben zakunim. His father sees him as somebody who is wise. His father sees him as being the leader of the brothers. He gives him the code for that reason. But the problem is of course, it causes hatred and jealousy. Yehuda takes a lot longer to find his leadership. But what I'm pointing out is that the elements that we will find in the next couple of weeks are already right over here in this week's parsha, both in terms of the arivut. Maybe I'll just say it on one step a little deeper. The word for arivut or arev in Aramaic. What's the word in Aramaic? Mashkon. The word mashkanta. The word mashkanta is over here, is the Aramaic for the word arev. And the word mashkanta is seen, again, from the more mystical explanations. The word mishkanta has the same words as mishkan, or mikdash, holiness, the mishkan, which means the mishkan is something which is where God rests. God rests when there is arevut, when God rests when there is togetherness, when there is unity. Sinat chinam, hatred, destroys the Beit HaMikdash. When there's a sense of togetherness or brotherness or brotherliness that creates the Beit HaMikdash. That is arevut. That is what Yehuda does. What is the arevut that Yehuda does? Yehuda takes responsibility for Binyamin. He says, I will serve as arev for Binyamin. I will serve as the collateral for Binyamin. Where is the Beit HaMikdash built? Exactly on the land which connects Yehuda and Binyamin. That's where there's Arevut, that's where there's the Mishkan, that's where the Beit HaMikdash would end up standing, which means this concept of Arevut, Mashkan, Mishkon, Mikdash, that's something which is absolutely profound, and I say it's much, much deeper than we see when we just look at the outside of the text. Shabbat Shalom.